From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a statewide coalition works to combat the stigma of mental illness in Wisconsin. Later, illustrator Linda Bleck talks about creating artwork for a Margaret Wise Brown collection and staying distinctive.
I do try to push forward in developing a style. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but that's just the nature of being an artist. You just want to push those boundaries and see what works and what doesn't.
And author Sue Monk Kidd's latest novel features real characters in the days leading up to the Civil War.
You know, someone said to me that they thought perhaps I had overstated the brutality of slavery and the invention of wings, and I thought, is this even possible? I mean, frankly, I couldn't even put all of it in there. It would be so raw for us to see.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's Monday morning, and welcome to the show. In the past year, politicians on both sides of the aisle have coalesced around the issue of mental health care. Additional new spending has been approved on several levels, and locally, a new board will be assigned to oversee the work of Milwaukee County's troubled mental health complex. But advocates for people with mental illness say in one area, not much has changed. A coalition of groups around Wisconsin has formed to take on what they see as a fundamental issue in mental health and mental illness, stigma. Sue McKenzie is the co-facilitative leader for WISE, the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination. She's also co-director of Rogers in Health, one of the members of the coalition. She joins us along with Jenny Otto, who works at Rogers Memorial Hospital and has a personal connection with the issue. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here, Mitch.
Thanks.
We have talked about the stigma of mental illness in the past on this show, but how do you quantify it? There are lots of different forms of mental illness, but is there one overarching image that you are working to combat?
When I think of stigma, I think there's lots of images. Probably some of the more recent ones that we would like to combat would be things like dangerousness and hopelessness. The best way for me to think about stigma is, first of all, not shaming and blaming people, because stigma is simply ideas that have been floating around from somewhere that become someone's beliefs and they play out in actions. And of course, we would like to change actions so that we all are more supportive, inclusive, that we stand in solidarity with each other.
Is there a multi-pronged issue with stigma? Is there stigma's impact on a personal level and stigma's impact on a societal level? And feel free to both chip in on this.
I'll introduce it, and then I think Jenny can really talk from personal experience. At WISE, we talk first and foremost about self-stigma, and that would be the person who's living with mental illness, addictions, early stages of wondering what's going on. And that self-stigma typically plays out in this sense that because of public stigma, people begin to think, well, I'm not good. And oftentimes then begin to think I'm not able. If maybe I'm challenged in one particular time in my life to do a particular thing, I might begin to believe that I'm not able. And then it plays out in apathy of, so why try? And obviously, stigma, what we're trying to do in increasing inclusion and hope and solidarity is help people to move towards I can, and others to see people as quite capable, as Jenny.
Jenny?
Yeah, for me, it probably definitely started with self-stigma. I think that what Sue said really represents it perfectly for me, is that I'd automatically started to think that, oh, I'm not well, there's something wrong with me, then I'm not able to do this. And then that started to manifest even deeper and start to affect you even more mentally and physically.
I don't know how much you feel you want to share, but did that self-stigma impact your ability to go and seek treatment?
I think initially for me, I'm 47 years old and I have been living with some challenges of mental health and anxiety since 1993. There is a family history in my family. I come from 9 kids and I've been challenged with the mental illness and then also been treated for that long. Looking back, I truly believe that I think I started to have challenges in childhood. Now that I was able to start to get treatment and start to examine and look at and want to. There was probably a struggle in there that it's like, you know, no, not me. I'm not going to be like my mother or my father or this person or that person.
I'm stronger than that.
Or, yeah, not me.
Right.
And I think it was probably a struggle for a while, even during, you know, that time from 1993 till there was a real pivotal point in May 2005 and March 2006 that I had two brothers commit suicide within 10 months of each other. And really that was a turning point for me, I think, that I started to believe or think that's not going to happen to me. And not in a way of not me of I'm not weak like that, but not me that I'm going to make a difference and I'm going to overcome this and work through this and persevere and fight for it. So
Mackenzie, is that a common dynamic? Is that that the self-stigma really impacts people's ability and desire to seek help?
Absolutely. And I think you can even hear in Jenny's story the amount of isolation. You know, she was figuring this out on her own and defining what was going on her own. And what we know about self-stigma and public stigma is the answer is just what Jenny's doing today. It's getting to know people who are living in recovery with mental illness. Because what I can do, and Jenny and I have been friends for quite a while now, if I start to have these kinds of feelings, I can go in one direction, you know, kind of internalize and wonder and try to make sense myself. Or I can say, you know what, I know Jenny, and Jenny's dealt with some really tough stuff in her life. And look at her, mom, successful relationship. She has this job where she's giving back to the community. So it's harder for me to define myself as hopeless when I start to know people who are dealing with all kinds of challenges that really have very hopeful lives.
And for me, too, I think it's, you know, when we say what has been helpful is being open and honest, one with myself and then with others. Being open to me means being open into taking a look back at everything that I have experienced, even if it is painful, and being open to receiving from people, and that's help. And open in presenting things to others of what works for me and it's, being, you know, successful.
It's really so common, isn't it? If we take this out of the realm of mental health, it's what we do for everything else. You know, hey, I got a skin rash. Take a look. What do you think? Have you ever had it
this
before?
This is why people Google and this is why people share that stuff on Facebook.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what was the catalyst for the coalition to come together, and why was that the strategy that that you decided to employ?
Well, it's really quite interesting. I've been working as an educator in the field of mental health for a number of years with a lot of colleagues across the state and country. And, you know, we went through a period of time where we thought the answer to reducing stigma was just to help people know more about mental illness. And, you know, we wanted people to understand the brain base and genetics. And all that is good. But what we found over time was that in America, we know more about mental illness, but we actually have had increased levels of stigma. Things aren't improving in that area. And I like to describe it as I think most of us, while we understand the pain of illness and challenge, not many of us understand the path of recovery. And you know, if we look around, where the images that we see most of are those of the illness, we don't hear a lot about what works in recovery. And recovery is the rule. Even for types of mental illnesses that many of us feel greatest fear around, schizophrenia, lots of fear around schizophrenia. And yet 2/3 of people, the rule is recovery.
Well, and so let me ask, maybe this is an indelicate question, but is one contributing factor to the stigma, the sort of highly publicized violent issues that have taken place involving, you know, mass shootings with people who turn out to have mental illness like schizophrenia?
Absolutely. And I know that shame and blame is not what's going to work here, but I think we need to face reality. With 24/7 media, we are being bombarded with the tough stories. We're not bombarded with the hopeful stories. And the tough stories are really a small percentage of the overall. But boy, if I'm starting to hear voices, which is not all that uncommon, but I don't know that. And then I think of what I've heard in terms of stories in the media. I'm going to have a really tough time with self-stigma.
What strikes me is that patients already have so much on their plate in working to overcome their illnesses that asking them to be out front as recovery is going on seems like it's asking a bit much.
It's a process, I think. It's a journey. It's a process. And as I have started to do it more, I think it's very freeing and empowering. And
do you have to be at a certain point in your recovery to be able to do that?
As someone who has to really think about the ethics behind this, I believe that every stage of recovery, we need to have people we can safely share with. And the goal of WISE isn't that everyone stand up and broadcast what's going on with them. There are some people who are at a place and make a personal choice to do that, and that's awesome. There are other people who live in isolation, who don't want to leave their apartment because they're afraid people will know what's going on with them. And, you know, one goal of WISE would be that there is a safe person, a safe place for that person to move out. So it's really about this continuum. And as I said, our goal isn't that we all are broadcasting, but thank goodness for people like Jenny who have been able to come to a place. And really, all the work around this shows that for anyone, and it's true for all of us, if we can stand authentically and talk about who we are, all of who we are, we feel pretty good about ourselves. And so it ends up being healing, but we need to be supportive of that decision.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just,
there are different levels of disclosure. And I remember going through this process and learning about all of this, that one thing that I said, I mean, I am a very talkative, vocal, outgoing person. It still took me a while, even doing this today. Any normal person's uncomfortable doing something they haven't done before, let alone putting their personal stories out there. I also thought that with telling my story and being open about it, maybe the person beside me isn't comfortable, but it does make them feel better that people are talking about it. So, you know, I'm speaking for others as well. We all don't have to be speaking about ourselves. Others can do it too. So,
Sue McKenzie, how will you know if this effort is working?
I love that question. Thank you. We are very invested in evaluation. We're working with Dr. Patrick Corrigan, who is an international stigma researcher, and there's validated tools for measuring stigma. And so WISE actually works as a consultant organization. We're looking for those organizations in local communities that want to make a difference. It can be a local congregation. It can be a workplace, really anyone. And what we help them with is the model that works to reduce stigma and to think about what would this model look like in my particular location and culture. And then we have these evaluation instruments that we help them to apply, and all of this is for free because we want as a state to be able to learn what's happening in different pockets so that as a state we get better at this.
This is really a statewide effort.
Absolutely. And our partners, NAMI, Mental Health America, Grassroots Empowerment, Wisconsin Family Ties, some of our statewide organizations, as well as many local organizations. And it's open to anyone to be involved in.
Well, Sue McKenzie and Jenny Otto, thank you so much and best of luck in your work.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thanks.
Sue McKenzie is the co-facilitative leader for WISE, the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination. She's also the co-director of Rogers In Health, one of the members of the initiative. Jenny Otto works at Rogers Memorial Hospital and has dealt with mental illness as well. We'll take a break now, and we'll be back with more of Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The U.S. Veterans Administration remains under fire from lawmakers and from the people it serves for significant delays veterans say they're dealing with in getting medical treatment. Representatives on both sides of the aisle are calling for action, some demanding that VA Secretary Eric Shinseki resign. But Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank says there are some leaders who could be doing more to ensure that the problems the VA is having are resolved.
CNN recently reported that when some patients called the Veterans Administration Hospital in Phoenix seeking an appointment, Their information was taken but not allowed to remain in the hospital's main computer. Instead, it was moved to a secret list, where it sat until an appointment was available within the 14 days mandated under VA standards. As a result, some people died before they were able to be seen, CNN claims. If this is true, and there is no reason to doubt it, then the VA staff members involved deserve condemnation. Some, notably the American Legion, have used the allegations to call for the resignation of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki. House Speaker John Boehner, reverting to the adult tendencies that allowed him to build a respected congressional career before it was hijacked by extreme right-wingers, disagreed. He said that Shinseki, who as Army Chief of Staff disputed some of the rosy scenarios for the Iraq War painted by other members of the George W. Bush administration, probably has a systemic problem at the VA and should be allowed to look into the situation and what might be done to address it. Congress is also holding hearings on the matter, as it should. But Boehner needs to go further. Instead of giving the go-ahead to spend untold millions of dollars on the staff of a publicity-seeking select committee examining the tragedy of the killing of the American ambassador to Libya in 2012, Boehner should approve use of the money to look into care requirements and rewards in the American healthcare system. The Libyan incident is being investigated to the point of ridiculousness by the Republican-controlled House. They are looking for some direct link between it and Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State at the time, and, not so coincidentally, a good bet to be the Democrats' next presidential nominee. But the ramifications of what is alleged to have happened in Phoenix are much more important to the health of Americans. What motivated the alleged actions at the Phoenix VA, meeting data-driven, bureaucratic standards of care and being rewarded for doing so, will become ever more important as Obamacare puts down roots. The Affordable Care Act, which created Obamacare, is chock full of such data-driven requirements and rewards. Managers of healthcare systems across the nation, many trained in business rather than medicine, increasingly are making meeting those standards to reap those rewards their primary goal, echoing what was being done at the Phoenix VA and, if Boehner's suspicions are correct, perhaps throughout the entire VA healthcare system. Having Congress take a good look at those numerical standards and rewards, and understanding how people are thinking of meeting their letter but not their spirit, would be an excellent exercise for a group of adult legislators. It might lead to a rational tweaking of the detailed guts of Obamacare. That isn't as sexy or as headline-grabbing as trying to bludgeon Hillary Clinton, but it is infinitely more important for the health of the American people.
Lake Effect essayist Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than three decades. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in a variety of publications. Time now for our weekly segment, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. There are some amazing advocates working for older adults in Milwaukee, and one of them is Stephanie Sue Stein. She's the director of the Milwaukee County Department on Aging, and she articulates their message really well.
They provide opportunities for older adults to give to this community, and many, many choices for older adults to live in our community in the way they want to live.
Stephanie embraces that Milwaukee has all different kinds of older adults, people with different interests, incomes, and support networks. Her agency spends a lot of time asking people what they need, and there are some problems that are unifying. They hear a lot about the lack of transportation options for older adults, particularly those who have stopped driving. Another unifying struggle was this.
Retirement income and other money in order to be able to live a good life, a life with choice, a life with mobility, a life with some beauty in it. And obviously that's not true for everyone. But the longer people live, the more likely it is that the money that they thought would last them their whole lives is not going to be there.
One of the big things that Stephanie fights for are social programs that support older adults.
Social Security and Medicare have allowed older people in this country to stay out of poverty. That's the biggest scary thing, is people don't understand those programs and don't understand that they're not charity, that they're earned programs that we all pay for and we all get.
We're going to return to Stephanie periodically to make sure we're understanding the big picture for older adults in Milwaukee and across the country. In addition to our questions of the day, we want to make sure that we're asking the big questions that can help us to stay more connected as we age. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. Another short break, and then Milwaukee area illustrator Linda Bleck is one of a handful of people to contribute artwork to a new collection of work written by the late children's author Margaret Wise Brown. We'll speak with her when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke. For as much as books and publishing have changed in the last decade, there are still some constants out there. And one of them is the children's book Goodnight Moon. Margaret Wise Brown's classic was first published in 1947 and has been on children's bookshelves ever since. And despite Margaret Wise Brown's death in 1952, much of her writing is still just being published for the first time. That includes the new collection of lullaby poems, Goodnight Songs. It's a collection of 12 works, each accompanied by art from a different illustrator. One of the dozen illustrators to be called on for the task was Mequon's Linda Bleck, who's with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show. It's been a few years.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I want to start with the very, very beginning of the process for you. How does an illustration project come your way?
Well, in this particular case, I had a working relationship with Sterling Publishing. I had done a series of 6 books called the Children's Treasury series, and I had worked with another art director, but Meredith Hart, who was the art director of Goodnight Songs, asked me to be one of the 12, which I was just elated. So that was – I'm always happy to do a Margaret Wise Brown book.
Well, and so what do you think it is that they see in your work that makes them think you're the right fit for them? And how do you decide whether it's the right project for you?
In this particular case, I probably wouldn't turn down a Margaret Wise Brown opportunity. However – you know, I'm always mystified, actually, and I always think, wow, somebody chose me. But I think it's my retro style. It has a little bit of the Golden Books feel.
I was just going to say, it looks like any number of books that that I remember on my shelf when I was little.
Sure. And I think maybe they're attracted to that type of style, although I would say of the other 12 that were involved in this project, I wouldn't say their work looks exactly like Golden Book work, but it has a little bit of that old-fashioned feel to it. And it really was up to Meredith's choice, and she personally went out and chose these people and artists. I think she went to a show, and she went to Society of Illustrators, and she saw some of the illustrators had won awards. So she just went on her personal taste.
How did the connection to the Margaret Wise Brown collection first happen for you? I feel like we talked about this years ago, but in case people missed that interview 5 or 6 years
yes.
ago.
Well, in 2007, late 2007, Thomas Nelson Publishers had approached me to do a book called The Moon Shines Down, which was about this little koala bear that traveled around the world. And so I worked on that book and finished that up in 2008. And that's where it all began. And then there was a long delay, and I had written some books and worked on other books in the meantime. So.
And Margaret Wise Brown, of course, best known for Goodnight Moon, but she passed away quite some time ago. But there seems like there is a remarkable amount of her work still out there that has never come to print before.
Well, that is the case, and she was 42 when she passed. But what Margaret Wise Brown was and is today is she was prolific. And Amy Gary, who was the editor of this book, had had a hunch that she might have some manuscripts that had never been published. And she went to Margaret Wise Brown's sister and asked if there might be some manuscripts or poems. And she said, sure. And she, with some coaxing, she went to the attic and they found this trunk. It was pretty amazing. It was filled with poems and lyrics, songs, books, sketches. It was just amazing. And so for the last 25 years, Amy has been on the experience of getting all these writings published. And Goodnight Songs was the song part of it. Margaret Wise Brown was hired by Disney and a record label to produce a show called – or songs for a show called The Noon Balloon. And this is where all these songs came out of that inspiration. And it really was just a love of Margaret Wise Brown's to combine written word and song.
Had you ever worked on a project where not only were the words going to be printed along with your work, but there was going to be a musical accompaniment to it as well?
This is the first project, and I'll tell you, we never got advanced listening of the songs.
I was just going to ask.
And so when I went to New York for the opening and I had the book and I popped the CD and I was so excited because it just added such a neat layer to the experience of reading the book, especially for a child. The songs are beautifully written and they're beautifully composed by Emily Gary and Tom Prout.
This latest project, you have one of 12 paintings or illustrations in the book. Is there any particular challenge in only getting one picture to portray a feeling, or is it liberating in a way?
Well, you go through a series of sketches, and at least in my case, and then you go through that self-editing stage. And this – because I was offered, you know, 2-page spread, I thought, oh, boy, that's a lot of space to fill up. But I try to put myself in the place of a young child. And for me, I like detail. So that's where I started. And there were some particular images that I've always wanted to illustrate. And I thought, what a perfect opportunity to maybe play with some of these other little animal characters like the hedgehog, the raccoon, and some little sleeping fish. But it really was just I wanted to – the one thing they said, keep it a nighttime scene. So I wanted to make it more like a transition from day to night.
Well, and an interesting point there is – I mean, it dawns on me, especially with this current book, so many books like this can be the last thing a child looks at before he or she goes to sleep.
Well, in this case, I would say I – love these songs, and I'm going to listen to them myself. They're very beautifully performed, and they have this lovely lilting quality about them and various different musical styles. So I just think, you know, for a parent, this would be a nice addition to their nighttime reading.
How much time do you spend with the text before you start to sketch out what you think the illustration might look like?
Well, I wouldn't say there's any specific time. In this case, they had sent me the poem, actually. And I probably read it over several times, and I maybe thought about it for a couple weeks. And then I start sketching out little scenes, and then I take those little scenes and I expand on them and I put them into the full layout, and then I go through that editing. In this case, I think I maybe worked on it for about a month. That's probably more time than I would normally, but it was just that I was given this one particular thing for the book, so I thought I'd take my time since it wasn't going to be due for 6 months.
Is there any – as you're doing this, in the back of your mind, are you curious who the other illustrators are and what they're putting together?
Well, I didn't have the opportunity to see what they were producing. And I actually did not know who the other illustrators were. I did get a chance to meet some of them when they had the launch in New York. And it was just a great collection of people and personalities. And I had a lot of fun meeting with them and hanging out with them afterwards. And so I just feel just honored to be a part of that group.
Talk about this style a little bit more. You talked about it as being kind of old-fashioned or retro. How influenced were you by the old golden books? And you know, when you became an illustrator, did you set out to be able to capture something along those lines, or is it just what comes out through your work?
It's not really an intentional style. I suppose I'm a little old-fashioned anyway. But you can't help but be influenced by what you grew up with. yes, I had the golden books. And we actually had a series of encyclopedias called the World Books. And there were a lot of illustrations that for some reason inspired me. I do try to push forward in developing a style. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but that's just the nature of being an artist. You just want to push those boundaries and see what works and what doesn't.
What are the kinds of stories you enjoy the most?
What stories do I like? Well, I like those stories that have a nice, you know, some all various types of stories, but I like ones that have a simple message. And the pictures are just rich and vibrant. So for me, that's what I like, but
obviously, there's no feedback to get from Margaret Wise Brown. But do you get feedback from the author? I know if I remember my interviews with you and a variety of other illustrators, there's really no contact between author and illustrator as the process is going on. But do you ever hear from authors after you have finished a project?
It's funny. I have never heard from another writer. Usually they'll say nice work or whatever. But yeah, I can't say that I have. I have half of the books I have done for writers. Some I've written myself.
Right.
And then as in the Children's Treasury series, those were I believe they're called non-domain. So there really wasn't a specific writer. And there were standards. So I guess unless I channeled them, I would
But it is interesting. I always think of this level of trust that you as the illustrator have to have that you know you believe that you're interpreting the author's words in a way that he or she would have wanted you to, and vice versa, the author in putting their stuff out into the world and trusting you with their message. They believe that you are going to get it right.
Well, yeah, and I think that's where the art director comes into play. They act as the mediator between the writer and the illustrator. And Meredith was so wonderful because she really did not edit very much. I think she maybe changed some of the elements in placing on the page and some color choices. But she really just wanted us to go out on a limb and do whatever we wanted. And that doesn't happen all the time. So yet again, just a wonderful, fun project. And I think that really contributed to its success.
Are there any projects on your radar that we ought to know about?
Well, let's see. I had a book, Santa's Hat, was released last year. And then this year I have a Lift the Flap book for Scholastic called What's in My Truck, which is a little chunky book. And so I'm kind of excited about that little book. It was a lot of fun to work on. And it was actually, although it was 5 pages, it took me 2 years to finish.
Wow.
It's not always about the length of the book. It's more about the content.
Absolutely. Well, Linda Black, it was delightful to catch up with you. Congratulations on this. It must be quite an honor to be able to be called on by the Margaret Wise Brown Estate, if you will.
Always, always an honor. So thank you so much for having me today.
And hope we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Linda Black is one of 12 illustrators whose work is in the new collection of lullaby poems by Margaret Wise Brown called Goodnight Songs. The hardcover edition of the book includes a CD featuring each of those songs. We're hearing the one Black illustrated called Goat on the Mountain. One more break now, and then author Sue Monk Kidd chats about her latest novel, The Invention of Wings. It's Lake Effect from WUWM.
Goat on the mountain, a goat on the hill, drank his little supper and drank his fill. And the goat on the mountain and the goat on the hill went to sleep on the night.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Sue Monk Kidd's latest book is a novel, but it's based on the very real lives of sisters Sarah and Angelita Grimke, abolitionists and suffragists in the first half of the 19th century. Their story is little told outside of academic circles, but Kidd would argue that it's just as important and just as interesting. The Invention of Wings is based on fact, but it's mainly a fictionalized account of Sarah and the slave girl Hetty, given to Sarah on her 11th birthday. The story follows the girls as they grow up and strive to become something larger than what society expected of them. Sue Monk Kidd spoke to an audience at the Milwaukee Public Library's Centennial Hall in February. Beforehand, she sat down with Lake Effect's Bonnie North and explained how she came to learn of the sisters.
I think it's ironic that I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, where these two women were born, and I had to go to New York to discover them. I went to the Brooklyn Museum to see Judy Chicago's dinner party exhibit. And it was there on their heritage panels that I came upon the names of Sarah and Angelina listed among 999 women who have made these significant contributions to Western history, really. And I didn't know who they were. And then I discovered they were from Charleston, where I was then living. So I came home and I plunged into learning about their lives. And I was completely captivated by who they were and what they accomplished. And probably what moved me most was what they had to overcome to do what they did.
Exactly. It's a story certainly of them trying very hard and succeeding quite well in trying to abolish slavery, but also it's a story of women's suffrage.
It is. Actually, Sarah and Angelina were the first official female abolition agents in our country. And not only that, they became some of the earliest feminist thinkers in America. Sarah wrote one of the first comprehensive feminist manifestos. And very few people know about that. And her sister, Angelina, was a great orator, and she was the first woman to speak before a legislative body in this country. But the two of them carried on an enormous public crusade for both abolition and women's rights. And yet they aren't as known in the popular culture as, say, a Lucretia Mott or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And I'm not sure why that is. I think they're well known in academics, probably in women's studies, women's history, and they might ring a vague bell in people's minds, but we don't seem to know them as readily. They're not as accessible to us in American history, so I hope maybe more people will discover them.
Me too, because I certainly thought I knew a lot about 19th century women's suffrage, more so than I knew about the abolitionist movement, although I know they dovetailed quite a lot. But I knew nothing about them, and I thought, oh my goodness, here's this whole treasure trove of history. Which leads me to ask you why this became a novel rather than a biography.
Gerda Lerner wrote a wonderful biography of the Grimke sisters that I highly recommend people reading. But I'm not a biographer. I'm not a historian. I'm a novelist. And the moment that I read about their lives, the incredible conflicts that they dealt with, what they had to give up, I mean, what they lost – it affected me as I think as women who were struggling to overcome, and that's a story. I'm a novelist, so I wanted to write a good story about them, a really thickly imagined story. And so that was the challenge I had, was how to weave their history, which I revere, with this deeply imagined story of their lives.
And that's where Handful comes in as well, because she's imagined, right? She is someone out of whole cloth for you.
She's largely imagined. She is inspired by one small footnote in history, in Sarah's diary, actually, where Sarah talks about being given an enslaved girl at some point, probably when she was around 11 or 12 years old. And this enslaved girl was named Hetty. And we only know that Sarah taught her to read, and they were caught and punished for this because this was a crime in South Carolina to teach an enslaved person to read. And then we know from her diary that Hetty died very early, probably in her adolescence. So with that little piece of information, I knew this was the other half of the story, and I wanted to develop this character and her story to entwine with Sarah. So yes, that was all largely and, well, maybe totally imagined, yes.
She's a wonderful character, and they balance each other so well, which I am sure is your intent. But there's something about her, and also the city of Charleston itself is also a character, and how Hetty and Charleston work with each other and together and how they experience each other. I found as I was reading the book that I could – I've never been to Charleston, and I felt like I could smell it.
Well, that's wonderful to hear because you want that sensuality in the story to affect all the reader's senses. So I want him to taste it and hear it and smell it too. But Charleston is a very sensual city, actually. It's a great city. In 1805-03, when these scenes were taking place and beginning in the story, you know, it was also a brutal place for enslaved people. And so I was trying to weave the story of Charleston into Hetty and Sarah's life because it is a place of enormous gravity in their lives. I mean, you can't separate that. Urban slavery formed who they were.
And that is a story of slavery I think a lot of us don't know about. I mean, we think of plantations and we think of that kind of slavery, but the house slaves, the people who live in an urban place, the way you describe them having to get the passage to go out to go buy the food to bring back, that sort of thing. Again, that was one of those things that I didn't really know about.
Well, urban slavery is quite different on the outside than plantation slavery. Of course, inside, it has the same sort of brutality going on. But it only could operate on a system of surveillance and control. And that is what was going on in Charleston. I mean, the enslaved people were on the streets all the time, going about errands for their owners, carrying on business. They were often let out for hire, as they said. And they were curfews and badges and passes and permissions. And there was something called the workhouse. There was a city guard to keep things in place. So that's how it was able to function. So it does look differently than plantation slavery. And I don't think Americans, we're as familiar with urban slavery maybe in our books and movies as we are, you know, with plantation slavery.
As you were taking the facts of Sarah's life and turning it into the story that you wanted to tell, was it difficult to incorporate? Did you have to leave things out that you most wanted to keep in the story but for whatever reason needed to remove them?
Well, as a novelist, my job is to serve that story. So, yes, you know, I had to leave things out, and I had to graft a lot of imagined scenes onto the truth. But I really think if you read The Invention of Wings, you will come away with a very good understanding of who Sarah Grimke was and what she accomplished, the kind of amazing feat she really did. And her turning points are in this book, the kind of internal process and angst and struggle that she went to, I wanted to portray. So there really is a lot of factual detail there, but that was important to me as a novelist, that she be represented.
The title, The Invention of Wings, where did that story come from? Because it's a wonderful story.
Yes. I wish I could say that I had knew of that story before I came up with the title. So I don't know if it was brewing somewhere in the back of my mind that I, you know, heard of that story or knew of it from an earlier time and it was just a seed in there. But I'm one of these authors that likes to get my title first. It's an odd idiosyncrasy, really, and I don't recommend it. But I was coming up with all kinds of titles so I could have something to focus my story. And I came up with The Invention of Wings. And I thought, yes, that really captures it. And it was only later that I came upon this wonderful African-American folktale about people from Africa being enslaved, brought to this country, and losing their wings. And the story goes that in Africa they could fly, but when they came here they lost their wings and they had to rediscover their wings. And it's a tale of great hope, really. And so obviously I was delighted to find that story and began to weave it into my novel.
You talked about before about the slaves being hired out, and Handful's mother is one of those people in this book because she's such a skilled seamstress. She has such a talent with the needle that, You know, she's able to make money. She's able to actually save money. And quilting plays a very important role. So needlework and the idea of sort of stitching a life.
Yes, this is an important aspect in the story. I wanted to portray a way for enslaved women to tell their stories, not just the oral tradition, but in a way that they could preserve this and pass it down in a very concrete way. And I came upon the quilts of a real historical figure, Harriet Powers, who quilted these beautiful masterpieces, really, of art and narration. And there, one of them is hanging in, well, it's not hanging, it's archived in the Smithsonian. And I went there to see it. And the moment I laid my eyes on this, I thought, we have to have a quilt in the story. And it will tell the story of Handful's mother. And she will use this in an almost subversive way to record what happened to her and what it feels like and what it is like to be an enslaved woman. And she creates a visual memoir. And I think the quilting, the taking these pieces of our lives and stitching them together into a whole, into a meaning, it's healing, and it gives us a sense of our life mattering, our life being witnessed. And those are significant parts of the story.
For you, as you came to the end of the writing of the book, did you find yourself thinking about enslavement differently? Did you find yourself finding anything new in there for you as a white woman?
Well, I think the one thing that was shocking to me, very disturbing to me, is that slavery was even worse than I had imagined it. You know, we study this in school, in history, and then we have ideas about slavery from books we read, sometimes for good and sometimes not for good. But when I read the slave narratives, to hear the testimony coming from the mouth of enslaved people themselves, and I'm talking about 19th century slave narratives and, for instance, like Solomon Northrop's 12 Years a Slave, Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Woman, and there are hundreds of them. And then the testimony, the narratives of the 1930s that were preserved finally in an oral way. When I read these, it was as if I was seeing slavery for the first time, really, because it was so much more it was more terrible than I had even imagined. And, you know, someone said to me that they thought perhaps I had overstated the brutality of slavery and the invention of wings. And I thought, is this even possible? I mean, frankly, I couldn't even put all of it in there. It would be so raw for us to see. So that was one thing that my research revealed to me. But I think, too, as a white woman in the South at that time, you know, they were vastly limited as well. It didn't compare to the subjugation of enslaved people, of course. But that was another shock for me, was just how limited, how few rights women really had, and how small their world could be as well.
Yeah, I think that is something that a lot of people don't realize, that, you know, both the horror of enslavement, but also the horror of having that sort of cultural limitation as well. And you interweave the two really well. And as you say, it's not as horrible as being owned by another person. But there's a certain really awfulness about a mind like Sarah's, who wanted to be a lawyer, you know, who could have probably been a phenomenal lawyer if she had been allowed to do it, not being able to do that simply because of sex.
Yes, that's right. And so race and gender are huge motifs in this story. And they're important to me personally, that we look at the legacies that this time left us. Sarah, she had a brilliant mind and such a yearning to become, to have her life matter in the world. So, you know, it makes you ache for her, really, to see how she yearned for that and how she was crushed almost at every turn. So it seems perfect somehow that she would end up out there on the front lines in her life, later in her life, fighting for a woman's right to speak in the public sphere and to live a life outside the domestic sphere. And, you know, we owe a great debt to these women. And one thing I hoped that the invention of wings would accomplish was just to show us how far we have come and how far we still have to go.
Well, Sue Monk-Kidd, it has been such a pleasure having you. Thank you so much. The book is called The Invention of Wings, and we will have all the information on the website.
Oh, thank you.
Sue Monk-Kidd's latest novel is called The Invention of Wings. She's also award-winning author of The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid Chair. She spoke with Bonnie North in February. You can hear her read two sections of the book, one in Sarah's voice and one in Hetty's, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's the Monday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.